Today is Wednesday, April 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, an iconic former First Lady of the United States has passed away.
It's been a life filled with adventure, laughter, love, and yes, some tears.
A high-level U.S. official has met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The U.S. Supreme Court hands a disappointment on immigration to the Trump administration. Also ahead, for the first time, a Pulitzer Prize goes to a hip-hop artist. It's all on today's International Edition. Barbara Bush, the plain-spoken First Lady who was at times more popular than her husband, President George H.W. Bush, died Tuesday at the age of 92. Mrs. Bush brought a grandmotherly style to Washington, often appearing in her trademark fake pearl chokers and displaying no vanity about her white hair and wrinkles. Mrs. Bush raised five children, George W., Jeb, Neil, Marvin, and Dorothy. A sixth child, three-year-old daughter Robin, died of leukemia in 1953. Here she is in 1990 giving a commencement speech at Wellesley College, where she joked about someday seeing the first woman president.
Somewhere out in this audience may even be someone who will one day follow in my footsteps and preside over the White House as the president's spouse, and I wish him well.
And joining us now to talk more about the life and legacy of this remarkable First Lady is Karen O'Connor, professor of political science at American University in Washington. Thanks for being with us. Talk a little bit about Barbara Bush's legacy.
She's one of only two women who not only were married to a president, but also became the mother of a future president. And in Barbara Bush's case, it might have been that she actually became mother to two presidents had Jeb Bush's attempt to get the Republican nomination succeeded. From the minute that Barbara Bush came on the scene when her husband was Ronald Reagan's vice president, they were immediately struck by how down-to-earth she actually was. And she comes from a well-to-do background. She attended college, but like most women of the day, dropped out to marry her sweetheart when he was back on leave from World War II. The Bushes together were some of those generation of great Americans who were losing every day. I think that the grace that she showed in dying is simply a continuation of the grace that we saw with her as First Lady. There was no pretense. She used to joke about the fact that she was mistaken as her husband's mother because she opted to gray or white hair naturally. She was known for the elements of her style in that she had traditional dress, always had a string of pearls, and always looked perfectly attired for the occasion. On top of that, coming after a Nancy Reagan presidency, Barbara Bush was in some ways just a breath of fresh air. She was somebody who would get down and hug little children. She made reading her cause to that end because she also loved her puppies and dogs. She even wrote a children's book about Millie, the White House dog, and loved nothing more than going into elementary schools all over the United States in reading from that book. She was somebody who was raised to be a traditional wife, and in many ways she was, in that she followed her husband when he decided to move different places and took different jobs with the U.S. government. But they were always a duo in I would say, quiet, not necessarily behind the scenes way, because I think that Barbara Bush is somebody that George Bush would have consulted as his wife in the way that Jimmy Carter did with Rosalind Carter. He viewed her, as far as I'm concerned, to be an equal, yet someone who really kept a large family together at times when he was frequently out of the home. To some extent, at times she was a single mom of five children and four boys. She also appeared to be a phenomenal grandmother. some women really take to that role. And when my daughter and I were discussing this today at lunch, and my daughter was tearing up about Barbara Bush, and I was kind of surprised about that. But she grew up knowing who Barbara Bush was, and the idea that her granddaughter is on a television show in the last few days talking about her grandma and giving stories about how not only did she love her grandma, but grandma loved now having great-grandchildren. And she also left the White House with dignity when her husband lost after only one term.
And boy, what a love story they had, just reading about the two of them and how they were just almost like one person.
72 years. Mm. And actually, although she did drop out of college to get married, went back to her college and got an honorary degree, and then later on, I think it was within the last few years, she wrote about the fact that she was still living with the love of her life, who she had been with together for 72 years.
And I understand she had a pretty mean sense of humor there, too, that she really was fun to be around.
She was fun. She was also the Barbara Bush when asked about other women would say, oh, it rhymes with witch, because she wasn't going to say bitch, but she wanted to make darn certain that people knew how she felt about. Also, her participation in the 2016 election, she was out there on the campaign stump for her son, Jeb Bush, at 90-plus years old. It's only her health maybe in the last 10 months that has been fading quite a bit, is while her husband also is obviously in not the greatest shape. The idea that you could be around long enough to enjoy 72 years of marriage with the person that you described, who you first met at Christmas time when you were 16 years old, is the love of their life, and that she still felt that way 72 years later, is something very special. And I think this Barbara Bush loved baseball almost as much as she loved her children. Some of the photographs of her in the stands rooting on the Astros just show that playful side to her that we did not necessarily always see. Always, I think, to America, seemed like the kind grandmother. And I think that when we think back about Barbara Bush, they are going to be drawn to the contrast an administration used to look like in terms of being honorable. In today's fractured times, you're going to see Republicans and Democrats alike mourning the loss of a wonderful woman.
That's Karen O'Connor, professor of political science at American University in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. State Department claims inspectors have not yet been allowed into Douma, Syria. Iranian environmental official, hated by conservatives, escapes Iran. The Senate leader halts a bill to protect the special counsel. And militants slay an Afghan boy for feeding police. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Trump is hosting Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at his Mar-a-Lago estate for two days of talks. Details now from VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman, who is in West Palm Beach, Florida.
Alongside the Japanese Prime Minister at the start of their talks, President Donald Trump said Seoul has his blessing to try to negotiate with Pyongyang an end to the 1950s Korean War.
People don't realize the Korean War has not ended. It's going on right now, and they are discussing an end to the war.
Active combat in the war ended in 1953 with an armistice signed by China, North Korea, and the United States, which commanded the United Nations forces. South Korea was not a signatory, and the two Koreas have never established diplomatic relations. The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Tuesday praised Trump for agreeing to hold a summit with North Korea's current leader, Kim Jong-un. The Japanese leader, saying such a decision took courage, also praises the U.S. president for maintaining a tough stance toward Pyongyang's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. Abe stating, "Donald, you demonstrated your unwavering determination in addressing the challenge of North Korea." Trump also revealed, sitting next to Abe, the level of U.S. contact with Pyongyang in preparation for his possible summit with North Korea's leader.
We've also started talking to North Korea directly. We have had direct talks at very high levels. Extremely high levels.
The discussions Tuesday at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort off Florida's Atlantic coast are focusing on North Korea and then turn to trade issues Wednesday, according to White House officials. The discussions will address Japan's key concerns. There is disappointment in Japan that despite the close relationship between Trump and Abe, the U.S. government has not exempted Tokyo from tariffs placed on steel and aluminum imports. Steve Herman, VOA News, West Palm Beach, Florida.
Well, meanwhile, we're learning that those high-level talks the president mentioned with North Korea involved the director of Central Intelligence, Mike Pompeo, who apparently met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just a few weeks ago. President Trump also suggesting Tuesday that his planned summit with Kim might not happen. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo, about the latest Trump comments.
Well, I think he's just stating, I think, what a lot of people know, and he's being safe, that he understands, and he's been told, he has good advisors who've told him that North Korea is unpredictable, it's mercurial, and that something may happen, so it's best not to get one's hopes up about the summit. But at the same time, it shows that this administration, as is often the case, has been underestimated by its opponents and has certainly made some good, concrete, tangible efforts to talk to North Korea rather than just ignoring them under a strategic patience policy. So it's not surprising, but I think Mr. Trump has correctly hedged his bets and is not counting on a summit until it actually takes place, because there is a lot that can happen to make it come off the rails, go wrong, and not happen.
Since he accepted the invitation many, many weeks ago, really not much has been made public.
That's probably the good thing, is that the sort of preparatory activities towards such a summit generally are best done in private, in secret, without the press and other, the commentariat, trying to tear it apart. And as I understand it, the CIA is playing a big role in the preparations. And you'd think that if anybody could, they could keep a secret. So this is it's sort of a surprise for one to see something being done without everybody knowing about it in advance.
Mr. Trump also said that they, referring to South and North Korea, have my blessing to discuss the end of the Korean conflict. People don't realize the war, he said, has not ended. It's going on right now, and they have been discussing an end to the war, subject to a deal that they have my blessing, and they do have my blessing to discuss that.
I think Mr. Trump taking, a pragmatic view of it, is that the idea being, well, let him talk and see what happens. You never know. I don't think Mr. Trump or anybody, certainly in Washington, has any idea how this will actually turn out. There's lots of speculation, particularly along the lines that President Moon is so naive or so desperate for a deal that he's going to come out on the short end of any sort of agreement reached with North Korea. And that would potentially cause some problems with the U.S. alliance. And it would also make the Japanese very uncomfortable. And that's part of the reason why Mr. Abe is in Florida right now.
All right. That's Grant Newsham, senior fellow or research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Tuesday that a provision of the U.S. immigration law that requires the mandatory deportation of immigrants convicted of crimes of violence is too vague to be enforced. The decision involves a native of the Philippines who came to the United States legally as a 13-year-old in 1992. After he pleaded no contest to two charges of burglary in California, the government began deportation proceedings against him. Well, the government argued, among other things, that he could be removed because of his convictions qualified as crimes of violence and that his allowed deportation under immigration law. Here to explain what all this means is attorney Anna Rose Matheson with the California Appellate Law Group in San Francisco. What's this all about?
So this is a law that allows or requires deportation for immigrants convicted of a crime of violence. So there are still a lot of other reasons in the statute. Congress provides all sorts of specific convictions that if you're convicted of, you have to be deported. What this case dealt with is what they call the residual clause. So in addition to all those other specific statutes where if you're convicted under murder or racketeering, you are automatically deported, this is essentially a catch-all broad clause at the end that says, or if you are convicted for a crime of violence, which as a general matter involves a substantial risk of use of physical force against the person or property of another.
Was the Trump Justice Department arguing in favor of continuing to deport these people and the court ruled against it? Is that how what happened?
Yes, although it's actually important to note that this case and the removal proceedings against the immigrant here were actually started under the Obama administration. So the administration didn't shift positions. The Obama administration began deportation proceedings against Mr. DiMaia, the immigrant at issue here, and the Trump administration carried on essentially following the same procedure as the prior administration. But the Supreme Court ruled against them, saying, no, the provision under which they're trying to deport this alien is unconstitutionally vague. So Congress could still try to fix it. But until Congress does, Congress can't pass vague laws. The laws have to be clear.
So where does it go from here?
This particular provision can't be used to deport Mr. DiMaia, who had been convicted of a couple prior burglaries, but none of them actually involved. He didn't actually use violence in any of these burglaries. So the next step is they could potentially try to institute removal proceedings based on other provisions of the Immigration Act. But really, at this point, this broad catch-all allowing for deportations for any crime of violence can't be used to deport people, unless and until Congress acts to clarify it and make clear in the statute exactly what qualifies as the sort of crime they believe immigrants should be removed from the country for.
That's Attorney Anna Rose Matthiessen with the California Appellate Law Group in San Francisco. You've been listening to International Edition on VOA.
This is Russ Davis. Join me as I take you to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. for the induction of Joanne Brackeen, Diane Reeves, and Pat Metheny into the hallowed hall of NEA Jazz Masters. The 2018 NEA Jazz Masters on the next Jazz America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. This week, we discuss the various tactics that the Kremlin uses to wage political warfare in Western democracies and how to combat it with Alina Polyakova, Senior Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. One passenger was killed and seven injured Tuesday when the engine aboard a Southwest Airlines flight from New York to Dallas, Texas, failed, forcing the jet to make an emergency landing in Philadelphia. Witnesses say engine parts hit a window and a passenger was almost sucked out of the jet. Amanda Borman was asleep on the plane when she awoke to a loud noise.
I mean, you instantly think that this is going to be it. This is your last moment, so you know you're going to die.
National Transportation Safety Board Chair Robert Sumwalt says there will be a thorough investigation.
The engine will be ultimately shipped off-site where we can do a detailed examination, teardown of the engine.
Investigators said the pilot reported engine trouble shortly after takeoff. Joining us now is former pilot and Dallas-based aviation attorney Will Angeli. So what exactly do you think happened here?
We had what appears to be an uncontained engine failure, which is to say the engine essentially blew up and sent shrapnel, bits and parts, back. I guess this woman was sitting in row 17, which was quite a few rows back from the engine, and it sent shrapnel through that window and broke the window out, which caused a decompression in the whole plane, and then as I understand it, that decompression immediately sucked her out of the window. Some of the passengers were reporting that, you know, she was out of the window, you know, from about the waist up. So her arms and her torso and her head were out the window, and they were trying to hold on to her.
That's unbelievable.
It's, you know, and I don't think anybody knows yet what happened to the engine. You know, an uncontained engine failure is always a horribly dangerous thing because these things are spinning so fast.
How unusual is something like this to happen?
Very unusual. These days, you know, these engines, they're horribly complex, but they're also tested and inspected constantly. And, you know, the design and the safety features and all that have evolved so much that they are very safe. This is something out of the ordinary. An NTSB higher up said something to the effect of he might see 2 or 3 uncontained engine failures a year, and none of them are in the United States.
What about the airline itself? How is their track record?
Southwest has an excellent safety record. They've, in fact, this is the first fatality that that airline has ever had on board one of its planes. And I don't even think anyone's ever been seriously injured on board their plane.
Where do the investigators go from here as far as looking into something like this?
They're going to pull that engine off and basically, you know, pull it down to its pieces and parts and investigate and look at every single piece of that thing. The irony is, you know, those engines, you see them when you get on the plane, they're big. Some of these are big enough to stand in. And these are large engines, but the pieces inside are not big. You know, my estimate is, unless there's just a general failure in some of bigger part, which is probably unlikely, it's going to end up being something small, the size of a coin, kind of small, that sent this engine into complete disaster.
But the plane was apparently able to land okay?
Yeah, they got it on the ground safely in Philadelphia. As I understand it, this event happened at cruise altitude, about 32 or 3,000 feet. It lost about half of its altitude pretty quickly and then came in and landed in Philadelphia safely, which is not unusual. You know, I mean, the engines just kind of move you forward. They don't keep you in the air necessarily. So if the engine on the other side of the plane is working fine, and it appears to have been, you can land that plane safely without any problem.
And what about legal issues that might come up from all of this?
They're going to be significant, I would imagine. An airline is a common carrier under the law, and they've got a heightened duty of care. You know, most ordinary people have a duty of care not to hurt others and not to do silly things to each other. An airline has a duty of care that's a step above that. I mean, they've essentially got to go out of their way to make sure that you're safe, because you're basically putting your life in their hands. And so Southwest is going to have some real legal liability issues as to the woman who died on the plane, and as I understand it, there were about 7 others that were injured, and so I would expect that, you know, they would make a claim as well.
All right, that's Dallas-based aviation attorney Will Angeli. Thanks for being with us. A prominent rapper has won a notable prize. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London tells International Edition's Sarah Williams all about it.
It is Kendrick Lamar, who, well, he's won 11 Grammy Awards in his career, which began in 2012 with his very first album. His latest album, Damn, has earned him 5 Grammy Awards. And now, this week, comes news that he's the first hip-hop artist, the first non-jazz classical music artist to win the Pulitzer Prize Award for the music category. So congratulations. And we're going to talk more about Kendrick Lamar and his latest album and his upcoming tour right after we check out his latest hit, which is called Love.
If I didn't ride blade on curve, would you still
love me?
If I'm in my mind at work, would you still
love me?
Keep it 100, I'd rather you trust me than to
love me.
Keep it a whole 100, don't got you, I got nothing.
Hey,
I got something.
I got something.
Hold up. We gon' function,
no assumption.
Feeling like Tyson with it.
Knock
it out twice, I'm with it. Only for the night.
Well, Larry, as you were saying, this is a tremendous honor for him to win this prize.
Yes, it is. It's made everybody in Compton proud because you just don't think of Compton as being a neighborhood where a Pulitzer Prize winner would be coming from. But Kendrick Lamar has credited a lot of different influences in his career. Tupac recently said it was really a large influence in the gangster rap, hip-hop era. Because everybody's just amazed and impressed with one accomplishment after another. 5 Grammy Awards for his latest album, Damn, and of course saw the huge success from his soundtrack to the film Black Panther. And he said that he would like to appear in Black Panther 2, and he hopes to be cast as a villain in the next Black Panther sequel. But he's just having a tremendously successful run right now, and it began, like I said, about 6 years ago with his first album. He is performing at various different festivals this coming up summer. Variety magazine has named him and his album the Hitmaker of the Year, and 5 Grammys, 11 in total, all of the other awards as well, Billboard Music Awards, MTV Music Awards, and everybody says they want to work with Kendrick Lamar. I heard Beyonce say that she'd like to collaborate with him as well. So everybody's talking about Kendrick Lamar, and I think this will only grow even bigger now that he's a Pulitzer Prize winner.
The fact that a rapper was selected for this, that's quite significant.
It is. In the history of this particular category, some 75 years ago, this is the first time that a hip-hop artist has won. You know, there's just so many things that have been going on with hip-hop and with the black culture these days. I mean, all of the inroads that the film Black Panther has made, becoming the third top-grossing film of all time, even topping Titanic. I think we're on a road here that we're not coming off of. And of course, Kendrick was a very loud spokesperson for the Black Lives Matter campaign and movement that continues. And so there's a lot of attention being given to the African-American community in the United States and worldwide. And I think we're on a path, as I say, that's exciting to be on, to be traveling on right now.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Communist government of China has intensified its crackdown on Christian communities as the number of converts continues to rise. Most recently, Chinese authorities have begun to implement a ban on online sales of the Bible. Bibles can only be purchased legally in state-approved Christian bookstores. This comes after the government's recent decision to reassign management of religious affairs, for decades run by a government department, to the Chinese Communist Party, which will be implementing new regulations that penalize all unregistered religious activities. Speaking to The Sun, a Christian Solidarity Worldwide spokesperson expressed concern over the increased persecution against Christians in China, saying the ban on selling Bibles online is deeply concerning and part of a wider pattern of violations of the right of freedom of religion or belief in China, which includes unregistered house churches. The government has also been conducting an ongoing campaign to destroy houses of worship, including Protestant and Catholic churches, institutes of Tibetan Buddhism, and mosques. For example, in January, Chinese authorities in Jiangxi province used dynamite and excavators to destroy the Golden Lampstand Church, an unregistered Protestant church with approximately 50,000 congregants. Chinese authorities have detained, tortured, prosecuted, and convicted religious leaders from a range of faith communities around the country. Some have died while in custody. The United States has condemned China for its ongoing repression of religious freedom. In December, the State Department redesignated China, along with 9 other states, as countries of particular concern for having engaged in or tolerated particularly severe violations of religious freedom. The U.S. Department of State's Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, stated, "I am deeply concerned by the Chinese government's tightening restrictions on religious practice. On March 30th, which was Good Friday, the government began enforcing a long-standing prohibition on the sale of Bibles online, and retailers who do not comply may face punishment. This decision and other actions by the Chinese government to prevent members of religious communities from practicing freely are unacceptable. I will be engaging the Chinese government directly on these issues to urge them to reverse course immediately."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.